Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Aware Show. This is Lisa Garr. I'm really, really excited about my guest today because we're talking about some things that you're really not going to hear in mainstream media right now because these are groundbreaking studies. Some of them are so cutting edge that people are sometimes afraid to talk about things like some things that are curing cancer in other places in the world. Experiments that are being done that are the largest mind over matter experiments in history that shows the power of the mind. What your doctors won't tell you, basically, or don't tell you because they're terrified or legally bound to not being able to tell you. So this is the conversation we're talking about today. We're cracking open a lot of belief systems. And joining me to do this is an award-winning journalist, author of 6 books, including her latest, which is The Bond, Lynn McTaggart. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me again on The Aware Show.
Hi, Lisa. It's great to be with you again.
It's great to talk to you, too, because you are threading together so many such interesting cutting-edge philosophies and materials. What makes you so curious about this, Lynn? I've interviewed you such a long time now, but I've never really asked you, why so curious about all these cutting-edge, you know, cancer cures and intention experiments and what your doctors don't tell you? Why are you so voraciously curious, my friend?
I don't know. I was born that way, I guess. Yeah. You know, it's my background as an investigative reporter.
Okay.
Honestly, Lisa, that always comes to the fore, even with books like The Field and The Bond and The Intention Experiment. I always go back to having to be a detective. You know, I'm a detective by nature, and in my next life, I'm going to be Nora Charles of Nick and Nora Charles, and my husband and I will be, you know, drunk all the time in a very fancy hotel and every so often be thrown a very difficult murder to solve. And we'll both love to solve it because we're both mad keen, you know, murder enthusiasts on, you know, for watching dramas. So I guess it's that impulse of having to find out why.
That's fun.
I mean, it powers me.
It's yeah. I mean, you have to be that way in order to do what you do, but then you also put it into action and then you ground it into reality with all of the science, because that's really the only way that you're going to get people to understand and to take action is when you put things in scientific terms. So let's talk a lot about the there's 2 different things we're going to talk about today. One is the intention experiments and the bond and what you've been covering with your books and so forth. But I want to start off by talking about some of these cancer therapies that are saving thousands of lives in different areas of the world. And these are people that you've actually interviewed and spoken with at length about the actual treatments that are happening. What started you on that journey?
Well, I think it was, what started me on the whole quest to find out about modern medicine had to do with a very personal journey to get well myself. I mean, I was ill in the mid-80s. I got ill and no one could figure out what was wrong with me. And I went from doctor to doctor, and then I went from alternative therapist to alternative therapist, and then I went to the very outer rim of alternative therapy, and, you know, I had certain bad things rolled out of me, and I, you know, learned a great deal about my relationship with my mother, but I never got better. No one could figure it out. So at a certain point, it occurred to me that I was going to have to figure this out myself. So I researched what I thought I had, and I found a nutritional pioneer, a doctor who was a nutritional pioneer at that time. Remember, this is mid-80s. It's, you know, all that time ago, 15 years ago. And And he, no, more than that, 20-something years ago.
Okay.
And he figured out what he thought I had, and we worked together as a partnership to get me better because he felt my participation was as important. And I was so impressed by that, you know, that partnership and that new relationship rather than a patient and doctor
right.
relationship, rather than a parent-child type thing, which is the way you have it with most doctors, that it was just a very heady experience of watching the power of getting well and the patient's participation and holistic therapies. And so, you know, I got pretty boring on the subject. I started telling everybody. And finally, my partner, who's now my husband, probably got pretty bored with listening to it. And so he turned to me one day and he said, well, you know, don't tell me, tell the world. So we launched What Doctors Don't Tell You 22 years ago. And
wow.
Wow. And it's going strong and about to become a magazine, international magazine, which is very exciting. And people are biting our hands off for it. And so a real cornerstone of that are and what we cover every month, and we cover all sorts of things every month. We look at the medical literature, and one of the big cornerstones is cancer therapy, because I am outraged at what happens with cancer patients. There's no other word for it. I am appalled, outraged, and just furious. And both passion and fury probably, probably power me. I've studied and I've seen firsthand the myriad therapies that can work with cancer, and yet this stuff is really suppressed. To give you an example, in the UK, there is a law here that bans anybody from advertising anything about a cancer therapy.
Wow.
Now, this law, this draconian law, was put into place in the mid-30s to stop people from peddling snake oil. So it probably had a good intention.
I see.
But now, no one can talk about promising therapies that work. And so,
I know you can't use the word cure, but you can't even use the word therapies?
No, you can't do anything about it. You can't advertise. You can write about it in the publications, which is why we do it all the time.
Oh.
But you cannot advertise anything about it. So, or, you know, it will be banned and the person thrown in prison. So there's all kinds of things, and there's also all kinds of politics at work in America with cancer. And the evidence that I've studied over and over, the people that I've seen, the doctors that I've interviewed, the patients that I've seen get better, including my own mother-in-law who had end-stage cancer, 3 months to live, breast cancer, so bad.
Wow.
She didn't have a breast anymore. It was raw meat. And a doctor completely turned her around with intravenous vitamin C. So this information needs to get out there.
There in the UK, though. That's where that happened, in the UK, right?
Sorry?
Dr. Kingsley worked with your mother-in-law in the United Kingdom, right?
Absolutely. But there are many doctors in the U.S. who do the same thing, who do this kind of life-saving therapy, because they realize and understand cancer as a process. They understand it as, you know, either something your body isn't getting or, most often, a bombarding of toxin that your body finally caves in under, and that it's a process, and getting better is a process of restoring things like cell communication, which is what vitamin C does. It reestablishes cell communication, which breaks down in cancer.
Oh, let's talk about that for a second. One of the things that I learned from listening to this, it was a teleseminar series that Lynn McTaggart did, from a doctor by the name of Dr. Patrick Kingsley, is who she interviewed, and he's basically the hope for the no-hopers in terms of doctors. He's located in the UK, but he talks all about the fact that cancer does not have to be a death sentence. It does not have to be something that you die from. This is something that is probably the most important thing that he wants to communicate. And then he talks all about these various different... Now, it's different for everyone, but what is the most important aspect of the vitamin C drips that are done in terms of both preventative and treatment?
Okay. Well, mainly those very high drips for vitamin C, and they're any therapies for cancer or for life-threatening infection. Use very high doses of vitamin C because, first of all, it's important to understand that vitamin C isn't actually a vitamin. It's not a micronutrient. It's an essential substance that is required in big amounts for our bodies to have cell communication. And as I say, in cancer, that breaks down. It's like having a burglary alarm system that a thief's able to turn off and sneak into your house and steal all your stuff. That's what happens with cancer. All of the, you know, killer cell information, the immune system stuff is turned off because of bad cell communication. And so that's what vitamin C does. It reestablishes it. Now, one of the really interesting things, though, about Kingsley's work is, you know, that has to really be administered by, you know, a therapist. And there's loads of people in the U.S. who do that. But he also talks a lot about what you can do for yourself. He takes patients off of dairy products because he finds that dairy products, a lot of dairy products, seem to be associated with cancer. He gives a simple supplements program, a simple vitamin and mineral program, high-dose vitamins and minerals of certain kinds that really help with antioxidant activity. And he talks about emotional stuff, too. So it's a real holistic approach. But a lot of it he talks about, and he encourages people to follow themselves.
To follow their own gut instincts, you mean?
No.
Follow themselves?
But there's lots of stuff they can do at home.
Oh, to do at home, I see.
Better.
When somebody receives a diagnosis of cancer, the last thing that they want to do is experiment, thinking, oh, this might work, this might work. That's why some of the chemotherapy treatments and so forth work are so widely prescribed here, because they have tested, scientific validated studies around it and so forth. But what people don't understand is that if you're trying something alternative, it has just as much validation behind it and just as many scientific studies behind it. It's just not as widely advertised because there's not a lot of big money behind it. You really cannot promote heavily, a lifestyle change and make any money on that, or you can't really patent vitamin C processes because it's a naturally occurring substance. So these are some of the reasons why it does help to get educated about these types of topics so that you can dive deeper into your learnings and so forth. These are some of the things that I didn't quite understand, and I looked at as, well, you need to go after the conventional treatments because that's what's tested and that's what's true, right?
Well, the conventional treatments are a lot less tested than you think. I mean, please understand that, and it's really important for people to understand that medicine is a business, like banking is a business.
Wow.
You know, we like to think of medicine as being this, you know, impartial information that is and products that have come via companies with everybody's best interests in heart. But the pharmaceutical business is the most profitable business in the world. And most doctors, and this is not the problem with doctors, most doctors are really well-intended, and they really want to try to make their patients well.
True.
But they only have a certain kind of tool, and the tool is primarily a drug. And the drug is prescribed, or is the doctor is educated primarily by drug salesmen. So after he leaves medical school, most of his information comes from drug detail men who are basically trying to sell a product,
right,
like anything else. So I study the medical literature every week, and I've done so for more than 20 years. And me and my husband are shocked every single week because we read about a lot of treatments that are taken for granted. And in this whole arc of running this publication, we've seen so many drugs, so many miracle drugs come and go. Vioxx, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread, which ended up killing loads and loads of patients. Patients died of heart attacks. And so many other things like that. Hormone replacement therapy, the best thing for women with menopause, now discovered unequivocally to cause cancer. Mm. So A lot of things get thrown out there on the market without adequate testing, or the studies themselves are manipulated. You have to really read between the lines to see what really that study's talking about. So a lot of stuff on the market is a lot more dangerous than we understand, and many things are tested a lot less than we think they are. And this is why there is the most outrageous statistic out there, which is nowadays the third leading cause of death, and it could be even the first or second by now, the third leading cause of death, according to the American Medical Association, is correctly prescribed drugs. The third leading cause of death in America. So
wow. We've
got to the point now where drugs are practically killing us more than anything else. And that's not drug mistakes. It's side effects of drugs.
Correctly prescribed drugs.
Correctly prescribed drugs. So the real issue here is this the right medicine? Is this the right way? And that's really what I try to answer, what our team tries to answer every month. What works and what doesn't work for any particular illness?
Well, it's amazing that you have this outlet, too, for people, because it's something that more and more and more people need to know about. And the name of the website, by the way, is What Doctors Don't Tell You. So that's WDDTY.com, What Doctors Don't Tell You. It's just the WDDTY.com. There are hundreds of different types of articles and so forth on there. But the idea of these types of things for prevention, well, I guess what you have to do is you have to start off by asking what cancer is and what types of things cause cancer, because there are so many different types of cancer, right?
Yeah. I mean, let's take, for instance, this is I was very sad to hear about Nora Ephron dying. And, you know, she just died. Very, very sad. Now, she died of leukemia. She had battled it for about 6 years. One little known fact that should have been checked out, you know, that should be checked out by anybody hearing of her death, is dark hair dye. Dark hair dye is known to cause things like leukemia and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And it's causing all kinds of problems and illnesses. I mean, this is really bad news. And I remember Nora Ephron saying that hair dye was one of the best things that ever happened to women. Well, it's one of those toxic substances that is particularly, particularly deadly for people using it over year after year after year. So there is, as I say, there's so many lifestyle things with cancer to look at. I know of a woman who had a golf ball-sized tumor. She didn't want to go the conventional route. She couldn't afford Patrick Kingsley's stuff and intravenous vitamin C. So all she did was remove the toxic toiletries in her life. You know, she looked at the labels and she realized she was using a lot of chemicals in her shampoos and all that sort of stuff. She took some homeopathy, her husband, who is a homeopath, prescribed, and she dealt with some emotional issues. The cancer disappeared. So I guess my message to everyone is not to not do anything, but to always understand cancer, you don't have to go with decisions overnight. You can investigate different ways to deal with cancer. You can look at the real batting average for conventional treatment, not what doctors tell you, but what they don't tell you, which is it's far less effective than they tell you, and what other things are far more effective than they tell you. So there's always time to really research this and to look at your lifestyle as a whole. Cancer, in a sense, is a wake-up call saying something in your life isn't working, so deal with it. Look at it, change it. You know, doctors sometimes say the most dangerous thing of all, go back and live your life just the way you lived it. No, cancer is all about saying, wake up, something in your life isn't working. So investigate and change.
Well, it's a bit of a rabbit hole, though, because there's so many things out there that are said to cause cancer, and there are so many toxins that we're exposed to, especially in the United States. I heard in one of the recordings that the Americans need higher doses of vitamin C because there are more toxins in America, which was very, very interesting to me. And I mean, just one of those things that we might not know that Lynn is from the U.S. but lives and resides in the U.K. now, and you have for how many years?
Oh, 30 years.
30 years, yeah. And so your perspectives are very interesting in terms of looking at both countries and really getting an interesting perspective on this. But this is across the globe. I mean, there are so many different countries that have different alternative treatments for cancer that we are not that are not available here in the U.S. And we've done shows on this, and I've seen a lot of DVDs on this, but when it actually comes down to prevention and where you can actually prevent yourself from getting to a place of receiving this diagnosis, I mean, green vegetables, yes, we talk a lot about those. Vitamin C in large doses, which I think does need to be taken intravenously rather than the supplements, right, Lynn, because of the accessibility?
Not for prevention. No, no. You can take 3 to 5 grams a day.
Okay.
It's really for treatment. But it comes down to, I mean, first of all, I don't want to scare people. People say, oh, my God, I can't control all the toxins. But you can control your own environment. You know, you may not be able to control air pollution or car exhaust, but what you can control is what you put on your body and what you take into your body, and also the emotions you have and the stress you deal with. I mean, cancer is also a disease of stress.
Mm.
So, as I say, it's something in your life isn't working. So most of the patients that I see that turn around their cancer just clean up their home. You know, they get rid of the toxic toiletries. They use more natural products that don't have an array of chemicals. They look again at cosmetics and use more natural cosmetics because cosmetics also have lots of carcinogens in them. They think twice about dyeing their hair. It's dark hair dye. That's the real problem.
Interesting. Right.
Look at their diet. Are they eating junk food? Or are they eating whole foods? You know, they start looking to organic whole foods. They start looking at their water. You know, it's your food and your water more than anything else that is really a toxic element, you know, the toxic environment. They start cleaning with natural products. They start, you know, not using things like air fresheners and all kinds of, you know, they cut down in the whole chemical environment that they have in their lives. That will make an enormous difference. And then if they start looking through that clean life, then they've got to also look at emotion because, you know, I interviewed Bernie Siegel.
Mm.
He's so wonderful about emotion. And basically what it seems to come down to is a lot of people who get cancer lose the joy in their lives. They lose the sense that it will ever get better. You know, remember that scene in As Good as It Gets where Melvin, Jack Nicholson, kind of turns to the other patients as he's desperate to see his therapist, and he goes, is this as good as it gets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's what a cancer patient thinks. He thinks it'll never get better than this. You know, it's always going to be this. It's a kind of trapped rat syndrome, and that can oftentimes just lead someone to a sense of just hopelessness or a what's-the-use sense. You know, and that oftentimes is something that characterizes some cancer patients, not all. And so oftentimes the patient that says, you know what, I've never mountain climbed in my life, I'm going to do that now, or I'm going to get out of this toxic relationship, or I'm going to forgive myself for whatever I did, those things can be huge cancer healers too.
That is true. So it's a combination of so many different things, which makes a lot of sense. You said something interesting, though. You said pharmaceutical business is the most profitable businesses in the world. Is that correct? Is that the
mm-hmm.
most? Really?
Yeah. Well, I guess banking is number one, but I suppose pharmaceuticals
right.
are, you know, right up there in the top five. Yeah, it is one of the most profitable in the world. It's just extraordinary, you know, how profitable drugs can be. And
I remember after 9/11, we were told immediately by George Bush that we should not stop taking our pharmaceuticals. I thought that struck me as so strange. It was one of the first few media addresses he had done after that incident. And I just thought that struck me. It is held in my head for decades now, so a decade. So it's been, I thought that was odd. So there, it definitely is a huge business.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess he was talking about don't, you know, let's not depress the pharmaceutical business, you know. That's part of a huge aspect of our economy. But it is, and it's just got really far away from a sense of healing. I'm sure that there are people in every pharmaceutical company in the research department who want to try to find cures for things. But I think one of the problems is that for all of the chronic diseases, medicine really doesn't cure. And I will say, hand on heart, that I think for emergency medicine,
Definitely, if I get
run over by a truck tomorrow, I want the best of high-tech medicine to put me back together.
Absolutely.
Again.
Emergency care, absolutely. Very, very, very important.
Without parallel in any other kind of medicine in the world.
Right.
But for every chronic disease, you know, arthritis, asthma, all of those things, all that medicine does essentially is suppress the problem. It can't really cure. And I keep looking for drugs that actually cure things. And about the best I can come up with is something for cold sores. You know, but other than antibiotics, drugs don't cure. They just treat or suppress or maintain or lower, like pain.
Right.
They don't cure. So the body, the basic problem with a drug is that it's a, you know, kind of linear process. It goes from A to B, you know, it put slots tab A into slot B.
Rather than getting to the root.
It doesn't
right.
work like that. The body is much more holistic. And so what ends up happening is tab A goes into slot B, but it also starts affecting C, D, E, F, G, and, you know, down to Z. So the body, all sorts of things happen as a result of that one attempt at suppressing something. And that's what ends up causing all the problems.
It's amazing. I mean, it really is. That's true. It is a root cause that you need to find. And sometimes Western medicine isn't really trained to look for the root, the systemic cause of it. And because it definitely is something that takes a while to track. But I like the fact that you don't make doctors wrong. I like the fact that you support the actual doctors. It's the system and the business of it that is something that has made it difficult for them. My father is a retired doctor, and yeah, the system was very challenging for him. He was one of the good guys who spent a lot of time with patients and added humor to his practice and so forth. But he had to deal with the insurance companies and payments and so forth. Running a business is pretty much what it's come down to in terms of being in private practice as a doctor. So it's an interesting profession, but I like the fact that you don't make them specifically wrong. What we're going to do is we're going to actually take a quick break, and I want to come back with Lynn McTaggart to talk about The Bond, which is one of her best-selling books, and also has received an award for Best New Science Book of 2012, and how all of this relates to our overall arching picture, talking about systemic issues of challenges of our times and basically how to thrive in these times. Cancer is a big part of that in terms of addressing the health of our world, but there's a much bigger picture that she has and addresses in her intention experiments. So we will be right back, Lynn, okay?
That sounds great.
All right. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to The Aware Show, but we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Aware Show. My guest is Lynn McTaggart, and we're talking about, well, we've been talking about alternative cancer therapies that are really literally saving the lives of thousands of people. But also Lynn has her incredible books. One of them is a Nautilus Award winner for Best New Science Book of 2012. That is The Bond, her book called The Bond, and which is really a how-to manual for getting through the many challenges of our times, but really about thriving beyond those challenges. And also she's the architect of the Intention Experiments, which was one of her original books as well. And those are some incredibly significant mind over matter experiments in history that she has been directing for many years now. So my first question to you is, Lynn, how do these all combine? What's the connection between the bond and the intention experiments and the cancer therapies? How does it all relate together in your world?
Well, what it relates to is essentially that we are something beyond a system of electricity and chemicals. You know, and that's the very reductive view we're given of who we are and how the world works. You know, we've been given this very materialist view of the universe that we're all, it's populated by separate things that are very well behaved, operating according to fixed laws in time and space, that our bodies are one more, you know, very elegant machine. That's really the current scientific view. And that our world is one great big machine, too. And that we, as little individual cogs, are meant to fight against each other, to compete in order to survive. That, in essence, is our worldview. But the new science coming to the fore that I discovered in the field, and I started researching the field because I came across a lot of really good studies from doing what doctors, all about spiritual healing and things like homeopathy. And I kept thinking to myself, if you can dilute something so much that it's not there anymore, but just have the water cure you, or if you have a thought and you can send it to someone else and make that person better, then this totally undermines everything we think about how we work, how the world works. And so there must be another way. And as you said earlier, that curiosity really set me off to try to find out what that might be. And I came across cutting-edge scientists and physicists and other scientists who were discovering and on the brink of what I recognized as a completely new view of the way the world works. They were on the brink of a revolution. And so I've really been investigating that ever since, looking at the role of consciousness and what consciousness is, you know, and it seems to be, you know, a substance with the capacity to change physical matter. And I've been looking at the body as something far bigger than, grander than, than chemical signaling, something that's an energetic, holistic system. And that's why medicine goes wrong. And that's why a lot of alternative medicine goes right, because it deals with the body as an energetic system.
You said something so interesting. Consciousness is a substance with the capacity to change physical matter. That's interesting. That's what you view consciousness as, a substance. That's interesting.
Well, it's a totality, actually.
Right.
It's hard to really nail down what consciousness is.
But many have tried,
why I've been doing the intention experiment, is to try to work it out.
Right. Well, I mean, many have tried, and I have myself personally asked that question for a long time. What is consciousness? Because, like, I host a radio show on consciousness, and I've constantly been trying to figure out what exactly is consciousness. And by interviewing so many great people like you, that was a really clear definition. It's a totality that has a capacity to change physical matter.
Yes, and it's also something, let's start off with what it isn't. It's not something that's locked inside our skull.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's what we're told by, again, materialist science. That's how it works. But there are so many exceptions to that rule. First of all of the near-dead patients, you know, who are completely aware of everything going on from the perspective of the top of the ceiling, you know, when they're dead. And when they come back to life, they can describe exactly what happened when they were dead.
Right.
I mean, there are many cases of that. And there are many cases of coma victims who know exactly what's going on when they're supposedly in a coma. So if the consciousness is part of a computer hard drive inside the brain, this is a point where the computer's unplugged. So it can't be something locked inside the skull. And we also see consciousness as something that is able to traverse time and space. You know, I've seen that with intention, scientific studies on intention and mind over matter. I've seen it with our intention experiment. You know, we have studies, you know, we've done 25 of them now.
Wow.
21 have shown a very positive, significant effect. And in all cases, I'm showing my internet audience, which is all around the world, a picture of our target. just a picture.
Oh, explain if our listeners don't know what the intention experiments are. Even I'm pretty sure most of them do. But what exactly are, you know, and which one is the one you're talking about right now with the target?
Okay, thank you for asking that, Lisa. I run periodic experiments, inviting my readers to come onto my website, theintentionexperiment.com, and send an intention to a target that's been set up by a scientist. And the main reason that we do this is to really test how far intention can go. Because, you know, it's such a big buzzword, Lisa. Everybody talks about doing stuff with intention.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was first looking at this, I got really curious about two things. One is, everybody's talking about the power of manifestation. So I kept thinking to myself, well, if this is so powerful, why are we doing it to manifest cars or more stuff or a new job? Why don't we use it to heal the world? Why don't we do some big, big thing with it? And how far can we take this? So that was one question. And the second question was, does it get supercharged when we have lots of people thinking the same thought at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I started these things, and I started working with a lot of prestigious scientists, psychologist Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona, and the late Rustam Roy from Penn State University, and Jessica Oates from University of California at Davis, Irvine, I think now, and, you know, a number of others around the world. And so we've set up these experiments. So the point is, we put a photo up, just a picture of whatever the target is, whether it's, you know, seeds and we're trying to make food grow faster, or a sample of water and we're trying to purify it, or even we've targeted countries to lower violence in certain areas. And so people will look at the photo and send an intention to that photo, that representation of the reality. And we, under vigorous scientific study, we find out we've had an effect over and over and over again. So, you know, this says some really interesting stuff about the nature of consciousness, that it's, you know, something that doesn't matter if you're right there. It's certainly something that can then go over many thousands of miles. I've had people in workshops of mine in Sydney sending intention for something sitting in a laboratory in Tucson, Arizona, and we've had a measurable scientific effect.
Wow. Wow, that's significant. What about water? Because there have been many experiments done on water. What specifically are you working with water?
Well, we've looked at trying to do lots of things, from trying to change basic physical properties of it, the cluster structure of the molecules, for instance, just to see if we could make it more like holy water, because the molecules, the H2O in water, the molecules cluster together like pieces of Lego, and they have different cluster structures depending on the nature of the water. So tap water is going to look very different, its cluster structure, its Lego set, than, say, water at Lourdes. So we were trying to send intention to purify the water, and we've done that, and to change the cluster structure. And we've demonstrated that even in a live experiment on Lake Biwa in Japan. We've also tried to alter the pH to make it more alkaline, which is supposedly more pure. And we've demonstrated we could do that.
A live?
We changed the pH, yeah.
A live experiment?
A live sample.
How did that work with a live experiment? You were watching it under a microscope with the intentions being set at the same time?
No, we took two samples of water. One was our control, the other was our target.
Mm-hmm.
And we got our internet audience around the globe, plus a live audience in Japan, to send intention to that water sample. And then I had a scientist on hand, Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, who's a real pioneer with a number of pieces of equipment that can measure very, 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 very subtle changes in systems and in water systems and in liquid systems. And he measured it right then and there, plus he measured the pH and showed a definite change. So we've done that, and we've done it with different kinds of equipment demonstrating alterations. So it's, you know, with each experiment we learn a little bit more, but there's no question from the evidence that we're amassing that consciousness has the capacity to change physical matter.
Wow. What's one of your favorite experiments that you've done out of the 24? You said 25, right?
Yeah, well, the last one we did was really fun. I did it on a radio show, actually. I did it on Coast to Coast.
Oh, right.
And I talked the host into letting me do a live experiment on the air. And so we had our, you know, they have something like 3-4 million listeners. So I had the biggest audience I've ever done with it. And we set an intention to lower violence in Washington. And I always disclose the target only when we start the experiment, so no one will start thinking at the target at the same time.
Right. Okay.
And we just did this as a real sense of, look, let's all bond together. And so we sent an intention to both lower violence in some of the violent areas in Washington. It's still a pretty violent place. Plus, we sent an intention to lower violence in Capitol Hill. And the very cool thing is one of my scientific team, there's a team working on this one, is Dr. Gary Schwartz, University of Arizona, mm-hmm. which has an Institute for Civil Discourse set up after that congresswoman got shot last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it has computer programs that can actually analyze spoken word speech to say whether or not it's civil. So we're going to take the congressional record before and after her experiment and see what happens. But one of the really fun things that did happen the day after our experiment,
right.
the current Speaker of the House, who loathes Nancy Pelosi, who is the former Speaker, the two of those hugged, and he said some lovely things about her. So we all sort of looked at this and said,
huh.
my goodness, did we have this immediate effect? So that was really quite fun.
Interesting. Have any studies come in since then that have shown the intention experiment in Washington worked?
No, we won't know for a couple of months. Remember, you have to wait. I just did this 2 weeks ago, and
Oh, okay.
We have to wait for a couple of months and then seriously analyze the data. Just as we did a 10th anniversary of 9/11 experiment. That was actually my favorite because I worked with a guy who has a big following in the Arab Gulf, who's very much a peacemaker. And he invited many of his followers, and I invited many of my other people around the world, my Western followers and people around the world, to join in. And we started out by a joint apology. He apologized on behalf of all the Arab countries, even though he's from Kuwait, which loves America. He apologized for what had happened with 9/11 and not for the Arab nations not being more vigilant about it. And I apologized for our outsized response, because what most people don't know is that hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghanistan people have been killed, detained, deported, or whatever, on behalf of that war, reprisal.
Mm-hmm.
So we apologized, and then we got together with a joint intention to lower violence and to restore peace in two provinces in southern Afghanistan, the two provinces that are the Taliban stronghold. And it was fabulous because, first of all, we had a very powerful effect. We analyzed the data afterward, which I got from NATO, actually got from a German general as part of the combined forces there. And there's no doubt that we had some very interesting data in just those two provinces of a big lowering of violence.
That is fascinating.
It was really interesting because it was actually really marked in those two provinces. But also what happened, which was really interesting, is the Arab participants and the Western participants started instant messaging each other one of the websites I was using, plus our Facebook pages. So they were starting to connect, hold hands, work together. It was just very, very cool.
That is exciting. I mean, that's moving. To see that happen in real time is amazing. So can we do this in small groups rather than, I mean, the intention experiments are amazing. If you want to participate in some of those, you can go to Lynn's website, and it is intentionexperiments.com. Is that right? I'm looking for your
website.
That's
it. Theintentionexperiment.com.
Right.
Yes.
So, but can we do this in smaller groups, and how many would be needed to make some significant change in our own community, in our own lives, maybe our own family?
That is such a great question, Lisa, because it's something that I investigated in my current book. I've been playing around with the power of small groups since I launched the intention experiment in 2007. And what I have found is that when people come together to do a little healing intention circle with somebody in the group with a healing channel challenge. Just a group of 6 or 8 or 12, the person gets better. I've been actually cataloging this and surveying people and really looking at that and compiling data. But the other interesting factor of it is the people sending the intention, they also get better.
Wow.
If they have some healing challenges, they get better. And so I started looking at this a little bit further in all kinds of ways. First of all, the science. When people come together, even strangers, because, I mean, a lot of these are done in my workshops where they're people who haven't met each other before. Even when it's strangers, when people come together for a larger goal, their brainwaves start resonating in synchrony.
Wow. Wow.
And even other parts of their body, you know, their breathing, their, you know, the way their blood flows, all of that starts resonating in synchrony. So they become closer and connected and bonded. And so I started, you know, thinking at first this is the power of intention. I think there's something more powerful than intention, and it's the power of connection. It seems to be, and that's what people talk about afterward, their lives are changed because they say, I've never felt so supported. I've never felt so connected to people. I felt like we were all one living organism.
Mm, mm.
And so one of the things that I've been looking at a lot is the power of these small groups and how they are going to be the power that really changes what's going on now in America.
We really want is connection. After all is said and done, is the connection with our communities, which we've kind of lost. And that's why the internet is such a big thing, is because it's about connection, even though it's a little bit distant. It's, you know, that is something that we are craving, I think, as a society.
It is. And, you know, we've been told such a bad story. We've been told that we are these, you know, these individuals who we have to struggle and compete to survive. And that's really been the vision we've had for America, you know, that this is a place where an individual can really make it. But now, actually, the vast majority of us are not making it anymore. And that's because that individualistic system has come to a real end point. You know, you get to a certain point where this is what selfish looks like. It looks like all systems breaking down, and that's kind of where we are now. But the guys in charge really don't know what to do, and they can't even talk to each other civilly, even with an intention experiment, I think.
Not right now.
You know, I think what we need is, you know, even the most spiritual of us, and I'm sure there's so many people listening to this show who are, you know, engaged in daily spiritual practice. That's your audience.
Right, definitely.
But all of us are imbued with that hard drive of lack, limitation, competition. And in order to get anywhere, we have to wipe that hard drive clean. And so one of the things that I've really been studying and looking at and practicing and providing tools for is the way of connecting better and creating something different. And that difference is not socialism, by the way. It's about using and leveraging yourself through the power of connection.
Interesting. It's very interesting, especially coming from London, where the Olympics are supposed to be, well, are happening. And that is such an interesting perspective. I'd love to hear what you have to say about it, because it is, the Olympic Games are a competition. And there are, you know, silver, gold, and everybody wants the gold, and that's one of the reasons why they're going there, is that chance of gold and so forth. But how do you suggest using the power of intention for something that is in the light of a competition?
Okay. Remember, the Olympic Games are important to everybody. They're a sort of symbol of our countries and all that sort of thing. So in one sense, they're a unifying cause. Sport is oftentimes, when it's political sport, is a real unifier. I mean, they found that in that wonderful movie Invictus, you know, the real-life story of how South Africa used its rugby team to unify the country after apartheid was first over. It's a unifier in one way, a national unifier. But actually, remember, at the end of the day, an Olympic sport is just a game. And a game has winners and losers. That's one of the places where it's okay to compete. But at the end of the game, it's a game. You know, I'm mm-hmm. always fascinated. It's very formal over here. When one of my daughters, who's quite sporty, plays games, you know, she plays on her school, all of her school games, mm-hmm. whoever wins, hip hip hoorays, or whoever loses, hip hip hoorays, the winner. And they all must shake hands and say, well done. You know, at the end of the game, even no matter how they fiercely competitive they've been on the team, at the end they say, it was just a game. Congratulations, you played really well. Well done.
And everybody goes
home and forgets about it. Hmm. And, you know, it's a game. But in real life, the problem is that kind of competitive mindset has been translated into every part of our lives so that we think the only way we can build a better mousetrap is to be competitive. And then that's gone into our educational model. The only way that kids can do well is to compete against each other and
right.
for us to have, you know, strictly streamed classes so that the dumb kids go in one class and the smart kids go in another. And, you know, we think the only way we can work properly in business is to seek, you know, to really guard what we've developed and not work with our competitors. The problem is it's all wrong. All of the new evidence coming to the fore is showing that when people work together, whether it's businesses working with businesses, education, children, A students working with C students in collaboration, and so on, everybody ups their game.
Isn't that
everybody
amazing?
Everybody ups their game. So, you know, there is a huge amount of evidence for that. But also, I think there's enormous amount of evidence, and this is what I really wanted to bring out here, for when you work, instead of trying to create a big top-down change, as we're trying to do in the U.S., when you work in small groups, just small groups of connected individuals, amazing avalanches of change happen.
That is so amazing. Our friend, we actually have a friend who's playing in the Olympics who's the Australian beach volleyballer. And this is her fifth Olympics, and she is also very, very strongly into the personal development arena and consciousness. She's got the entire country rallying behind her because she teaches fitness to the country. She has a goal to lower the overall weight of children in Australia. So she has such a beautiful bigger picture with what it means about fitness and about, you know, the sustainability of fitness, that it's the whole entire country has gotten behind her, and she's going for her fifth gold. And she's such a beautiful person anyway. Her name is Natalie Cook, and she has, you know, the intention there is correct. And that's, I think, what you're talking about, Lynn, is the right way to use sport, or the right way to use education, so that it is still about the bigger picture of it all, the bigger goal of it all, which is, in her case, fitness. Or in educational arena, it's maybe about, you know, reading and writing and learning how to make the world a better place. There's so many different things that you can connect to the ideas of, you know, even athletes and education, that don't have to do with, you know, using drugs in order to make yourself win the gold medal, or cheating on tests in order to get through school. You know, there's a lot of a bigger picture that I think that we're missing. I love that you said in the beginning is that when I asked you really, when I've been taking five pages of notes right now from just this hour long show, but you said that we are more than one person in the universe, and that's your overall goal there, Lynn, is that between the bond and the field and the intention experiments and the what doctors don't tell you, is that really that we are part of such a bigger whole. And if we can really get that, if we can understand that, you know, to really chunk up and realize that we are part of such a bigger whole, then that will serve us individually. It still takes care of the what's in it for me, you know, place that everybody's in.
Yeah. Well, you know, it leverages everything more for you as an individual. That's what I tried to put together in the paperback version of the Bond, which has a lot of practices and exercises, is teaching people how to work better for themselves by including the group, by using connection. For instance, there's been some really great studies showing that, you know, we all know about affirmations, you know, I look beautiful today, mm-hmm. I am having a great day, all of those affirmations that we're all taught to use. Well, there's been some studies showing that when you use we affirmations, you know, we're having a good day, everybody in my office is going to do really well together, you know what happens? Your own individual performance gets better.
Interesting. Isn't that interesting? Yes.
It's really interesting because it's, you know, it's all about that power of small groups and the power of hooking into the mothership, because that you so beautifully said, what, you know, probably more clearly than I can understand my own words, is that, yeah, I'm always saying that, you know, we're part of this much bigger, vast whole. We're part of a galactic, you know, an intergalactic superorganism. That's what we are.
Wow.
And when we can operate in that, with that flow, and not individualistically and just for, you know, just for ourselves as a little particle of that, then everything about our flow is going to improve.
Wow, you've just so much fun to talk to. Unfortunately, we have to wrap this up, but and we just have a minute left. But, I mean, what do you do in your downtime? You are such a visionary. How, my goodness, you have so many great things that you have to say. I am so glad that you are a part of this show. Thank you so much, Lynn. You're fabulous. Just fabulous.
Oh, well, thank you, Lisa. I really enjoyed this. And it was fun kind of going through all of the stuff that I've done, too. Thanks.
To connect your life's work in an hour, it was just
I know. Really great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so Lynn McTaggart is my guest, and you can find out more about her book at thebond.com, and you can find out about her other, the intention experiments and what doctors don't tell you from there as well. Thanks
can
again,
I
Lynn.
Just, Lisa, can I just say it's thebond.net, excuse me.
Thank you.
Sorry.
All right, thank you again.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
All right, and thank you very much for listening. And thank you, D'Angelo, on the board here at KPFK, Joyce Walker, Gina Salvati. Thank you all so much. There are our production goddesses for the Aware Show. Until next time, this is Lisa Garr, and I invite you to stay aware.